Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Fiction. Science fiction. Horror. Fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCBQ 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
Welcome back into the House of Mystery, and I'm your host today, Al Warren. Joining me, we've got author of Summer Club, a novel. It's Catherine Dean Mazurov. Thank you for being here, Kath.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Al.
Wow. So now this looks to me like is this your first book that you've had published?
Yes, it is.
Okay. What made you decide that you wanted to write and write something that you wanted people to read, like actually get out there and publish?
Well, I'll start out by saying I have two confessions. One is I'd never planned or aspired to write a novel or a book of any kind. And when I did start writing the book, I did not initially anticipate it to be a mystery or a suspense book. Like the protagonist in the book, Lydia Phillips, I am a career journalist. I spent several years working for the Denver Post as a reporter and editor. I've done quite a bit of magazine writing and written for the global energy industry and so on. So I've had a career of writing. And I suppose since I wrote for a living and every day, the idea of writing a book on the side just seemed too daunting. But anyway, people would often ask me, have you ever considered writing a book? And my answer was always the same. No, I have no interest in doing this. What changed was when I quit my job to stay home full time with my young son, who was 10 at the time. My husband traveled a lot. So at the Post, I was an assistant city editor at the time and working crazy hours and so on. So, you know, on a newspaper, you kind of have to stay until it's done. So anyway, I made this big decision to quit my job, and I actually left right after the Columbine shooting. So It was a good time. I had already planned it, but it was a good time for me to do that. The first thing I did was clean his room because the killers in that shooting, you know, had pretty much planned the entire event from their bedrooms, basement, and garage. So that was the first thing I did. Didn't find any guns or bombs or anything. So anyway, I suddenly was at home and leaving this adrenaline-filled world of drive-by shootings and court cases and crazy stories, and started, you know, as a way to fill the void, I started doing volunteer work, and I volunteered for a lot of things, mostly on behalf of my son, but I did branch out a bit and eventually found myself as president of our swim club, which my husband had told me, please don't do this. I did it anyway. My thinking was, how bad can this be? I mean, you know, after being in the, you know, deadline pressure newsroom with people throwing tantrums and ego trips and so on, I mean, this is, I can hang out at the pool, work on my tan, and just have a great summer, play tennis. We've got somebody who runs the club, basically, so this will be fine. Well, I couldn't have been more wrong. It made my days in the newsroom seem like child's play. And I just kept saying to myself, you can't make this stuff up. I've got to write a book. So I finally did start writing the book about 8 years ago. And what inspired me at that point was I've always been fascinated by the sort of universal foibles of human nature and interpersonal dynamics that emerge when people are thrown together in a situation, whether it's the swim club or PTA or the HOA or some kind of volunteer board. You know, these behaviors emerge, and it's power trips and politics and snarkiness, and people have their own agendas, and there's a lot of complaining. So I kind of viewed this as a microcosm of society, a universal example of what happens in these situations. So I started writing the book, and it was full of all these crazy goings on that had occurred throughout the course of this one summer, one steamy, crazy summer, where, you know, I just went on and on. And I would say probably about 70% of the little stories in the book are based on true events. I disguised the characters, of course, and changed the specific scenarios, but they all occurred, you know, in connection to the club, involving people connected to the club. Mm-hmm. But as I got further into the book, I realized it wasn't enough. And I realized I needed to introduce a dark element to create some tension. So I started researching, you know, what could this be? Could the club be a front for a drug ring or organized crime activity or something? And I researched it, and I got stuck because I couldn't find anything that could easily be woven into the story. So I put it aside. I also got very busy with some other freelance work. So I just sort of forgot about the book for about three or four years, and just didn't think about it. And then I happened to be talking to a former colleague and mentioned it to her, and she said, oh, you should pick it back up and write it. So I did. So about 3.5 years ago, I did pick the book back up. And meanwhile, I got wind of through a friend of ours who'd been associated with a company involved in a real estate investment scam. And he kind of told me the basic story. I queried him about it, then did some research on real estate investment and Ponzi schemes, and kind of came up with this scheme for the book, and was able to then weave it into the story. It's a process that took me almost exactly 3 years to go from that point. I'd written about a third of the book, maybe a little bit more, and it took me about 3 years to finish it, and involved, you know, a lot of rewriting, editing, and so on. And by doing that, then I was able to take the story from simply poop in the pool to a body in the river, and create that element of suspense while still keeping the book sort of the funny, fun caper it was. I didn't want to get real graphic with the crime. The reader does not actually experience the murder, but a murder happens. I didn't get real graphic with the finding of the body and the forensics and so on. I just kind of wanted to keep it the tone of the book where I had started. And that's sort of how it came to be. So it is, again, it's my first novel. It was interesting transitioning from nonfiction to fiction. I found myself at times sort of rushing through scenes, thinking I'm on deadline and I've only got so much space. And people with my beta readers were saying, slow it down, you know, flesh these scenes out, describe the characters, go for it. So I had to pace myself. I had to learn how to pace myself to allow that to happen.
And these characters, so you say that it's loosely or it's based on true events and stuff. So the actual characters, how much of you are it, you know, how much of you, your own personal feelings and who you are and what makes up you go into these characters?
You mean how much of it is, how much it,
how much comes from you? Like when you take a character and they're in a scene and they're acting and reacting to things going on, to the story that you're going along, how much of you yourself do you put into some of these characters?
I put quite a bit of myself into the protagonist, Lydia Phillips, who is a journalist turned stay-at-home mom who immerses herself in volunteer work and so on. The other characters are, some are made up. Some of the characters are made up. Others are basically amalgams of people who I, not necessarily affiliated with the swim club, but people from, you know, the neighborhood or the high school my son attended or other people in my life who I've come across who exhibit some of these behaviors. But I tried to be very careful and, again, would maybe combine two or three characters into one. You know, it's amazing when you start looking at people and looking at these characteristics, it's who's out there. I mean, you run across these people in everyday life all the time.
Oh, it's amazing.
Yeah.
You know, I guess there's the big difference when you're doing writing about stories in nonfiction. You don't really get to choose the ending, or you don't really get to choose where the story goes, because it's you're telling the story that happened. So when you go to fiction, did you find that kind of, I guess, rewarding? Did you like being able to take the story where you wanted it to go?
Yes, as I got further into the book, I realized I felt so liberated. I could, you know, make the ending however I wanted and create my own dialogue and use my imagination to embellish the characters. And I liked that aspect. I learned that I really liked fiction writing, whereas even though I'd come from a world of nonfiction and spent decades doing that, I found fiction to be fun. And I really got into it. So, you know, along the way, I guess in my early years as a journalist, there were two trends that were emerging. One in the 70s, basically. One was inspired by Watergate and the, you know, Pulitzer Prize winning book, you know, reporting book and so on, that the Washington Post did. I mean, everybody wanted to be Woodward and Bernstein and be an investigative reporter.
Right.
The other trend that was emerging was what's referred to as the new journalism, a term that was coined by Tom Wolfe, who of course wrote The Right Stuff, nonfiction. And it basically is about the, you know, the nonfiction novel, writing true stories that read like a novel. And I'd always been, interested in that. And I think that made a big impact on journalism and reporting. I think many reporters use elements of that style in their reporting, which in a daily newspaper is not easy because you're so constrained by deadlines and space, but it's very prolific in magazine writing and then also books where you basically use creative writing elements to report or tell a story of a real event. To me, the most iconic of these is In Cold Blood by Truman Capote, where he spent, I don't know how many thousands of hours interviewing the criminals of this horrific murder in Kansas back in the 50s. But, you know, he retraced their steps. He recreated the whole crime, and it reads like a novel. So another author who has used that element is Joe McGinnis in writing the book Fatal Vision about, I think he's a captain, Dr. Jeffrey McDonald, who killed his wife and children in North Carolina, and hired Joe McGinnis to tell his side of the story when he was in jail. And in the course of interviewing him, Joe McGinnis realized, no, you did it. So I'm going to write this book that shows you did it. And then there was a lawsuit and so on. But the book, another book that just reads like this gripping novel. And that kind of writing has always intrigued me. And I felt like writing this book, even though this was fiction, I was able to call on that and kind of implement that style in the book.
Right, right. So did you not consider ever just doing a nonfiction, like taking a real story that you had dealt with and developing a book or a novel around that?
You know, I have not. I know lots of journalists who have done that. And of course, you've done that many times in your books. I mean, it always makes for good copy, good books, because people, I think, love to read about crimes and they love mysteries and suspense. And it's a great genre for that kind of writing. I think people are very motivated to write it, and I think they know people like want to read it. People want to read stories about what motivates people to commit terrible things. And but no, I have never actually done that. I sort of jumped from not wanting to write a book, fiction or nonfiction, to suddenly this fiction book. But it was inspired by this was not a fantasy book. I almost could have made it's sort of two books coming together. The stories about the swim club, I could have written as nonfiction, made it an expose, but I didn't. So I disguised the characters and made up some of the characters and events.
Well, I will say, when you write a story about an event that happened that's still current, or people are still alive around it, it does put a responsibility on you, and it makes you feel a lot of stress during and after the time, because everyone involved reads it, and you have to hope everyone is happy, and that's a really tough thing to do.
Yes, it is.
You know, but so why didn't you make it nonfiction? Like, why didn't you just go on out there and do it as a nonfiction true story?
Well, I didn't want to make it an expose. I didn't want to expose what were in many cases really bad behaviors by people. And so, you know, I felt like I had enough to go on to make it a fiction book, and I could combine, you know, could disguise the characters. And I think there's enough, and as I said, I used aspects of characters from other parts of my life, because again, these are universal behaviors. You see this kind of stuff emerging in so many situations of people, you know, the politics, the backstabbing, everything. It's just, and I'm finding that people who have been involved in those kinds of activities can relate to it.
It's in almost every part of society, really.
You
just kind of have to look and go into that part, and you start to realize that it crops up everywhere.
Yes.
How do you choose, like, which kind of storylines you want to run, like, in a book like this? And I mean, like, okay, so there's the body itself and you've got a few things, but how do you know, like, what is good for you to put out, like, and which kind of little thing happens throughout the book?
Well, you know, some of it as I said, about 70% of the events really did happen. So I called on those. I guess I wanted to, for example, there's one character who consistently cheats on the tennis court. And this is common when you get into league tennis, it's the cheating. And so that was an easy one because I knew people could relate to it. People who had played tennis could relate, and they have. I mean, we've all experienced that. The neurotic swim team mom, you know, with multiple stopwatches and arguing with the timers and the judges and so on. That's pretty universal. I mean, these characters, it was easy for me to come up with the scenarios because it was a swim and tennis club. So obviously wanted to include things about tennis, things about swimming, but also the drunken soirees, parties, and this happened to be a very sort of derelict, rundown, dysfunctional facility. It was sort of an eyesore in the neighborhood that had been experienced hard times in the past, and it had an aging boiler, so it had a lot of problems, and it had a sort of a revolving door of club managers who'd been micromanaged by board members who would go into the boiler room with their six packs and try to fiddle with it. And so it provided, and that really was kind of the way the club was in real life. It is no longer that way now, but that provided a great backdrop for, you know, the scene, the setting. This was not a posh place. It was kind of a dump. But in every summer, these from Memorial Day to Labor Day, these people would come together and play tennis and watch their kids swim and party and so on. And then it's over at Labor Day. And so, you know, there was enough to go on that really happened that got me started. And then from there, I fiddled with the characters and exaggerated some of the events or changed some of the events. To basically fictionalize the book.
Did you have a subtext, or do you have some sort of a, you know, if someone picks up your book, someone picks up Summer Club and they read it, at the end of the book, besides the, you know, the murder and the basic story itself, is there something you wanted people to get out of the book?
Well, I wanted people to read and enjoy the book. I tried to make it fun and funny and sort of a light summer beach read. I mean, I think books need to do at least one of three things. They need to entertain. They need to resonate with people, or they need to enlighten or educate people. I don't know that a book necessarily needs to do all of those things, but it certainly needs to do at least one of those things. I wanted my book to entertain people, and I wanted it to resonate with people. I wanted people to read my book and say, I know that person. I've been in that situation, you know, and laugh. I wanted people to laugh and recognize aspects from their own lives that were happening in the story.
So now that you've written the book and it's out, how do you like writing, like compared to doing nonfiction? Would you ever go back to being a reporter or doing nonfiction, or is this kind of where you're going to head now?
I probably would head more in this direction versus nonfiction. I'm considering a second book, but I haven't quite worked it out yet. It may be sort of a sequel in that Lydia Phillips, the protagonist, may come back. I have always loved the process of writing, whether it's fiction or nonfiction. As I got more into this book, I really enjoyed the fiction aspects of it based on what I said earlier, which was that, you know, I could use my imagination and I could make up dialogue and make up my own ending. And that freedom to do that was wonderful. But I've always enjoyed the process of writing. Most of my career as a writer least from the newspaper, has been as a features writer versus hard news. I have written hard news, covered cops and courts and so on, but I spent a lot of time in the features section, which allows a little bit more leeway in terms of your writing style, allows you to incorporate more creativity. You're not just reporting, you know, a man was shot Tuesday night and a drive-by shooting, blah, blah, blah. It was, you had a little more room to be creative. And I have always enjoyed the process. I started writing when I was 18 years old on my college newspaper staff. And so I've done it for a long time. I like the process of figuring out how to put it all together. I've always kind of viewed writing as a construction project where you have to sort of figure out what's the story, how do I design this story, what's it about, where's it going, what's the angle, and then write it. I think a huge part of writing is organization. And so organizing it such and then making it all fit together with the right transitions and so on. I've always loved that process. I guess I'm a problem solver by nature, and I think it's you're solving problem when you write something. It's a process, and I think it's a craft. I think writers, not necessarily more so than being artists or creative individuals. There is certainly creativity involved, but because you have to have the idea, or you have to, if it's a story that's presented to you, then you have to write it in such a way that people are going to read it and people are going to be interested in it. And so I think that's, in that way, I think it's a craft, and you're constantly, writers, I think, are constantly honing their craft and trying to be better. And I still, looking at a blank page is the worst part of the process, starting out, as I'm sure you can relate to. Where do I start? And I think every writer faces that. I've done this for many, many years. I still face that. I don't panic, though, because I know I can do it ultimately. I will, because I've done it so many times. I've always been able to start the story. And
when do you feel confident enough that it's ready to publish? But so when you're looking at the page and you're slowly working your way through and stuff, and even when, you know, because you've done a lot of stories, of course, a lot of it was dated because you're working for a place that requires it at a time, but there must be a certain point when you go, yeah, this is it.
Well, that's interesting. You know, I thought I finished my first draft in February of 2019, and I thought, okay, I'm done. So I had some beta readers look at it, and then I read through it again, and I realized, and I actually went ahead and submitted it to my publisher. And as I went through it again, and then they sent back a proof, and I went through it again. I thought, this is not done. This is not done. Not only were there were some mistakes. I thought right, going through it over and over, correcting things, but I started doing rewriting on it. And then that even led to more, you know, typos and things like that. So finally,
millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Finally, my publisher said, just resubmit the manuscript. So I spent the next year basically rewriting this, going over it and over it, having people read it over and over again. And finally, last summer, I thought, okay, this is as good as it's going to get. So I just went ahead and did it, which you have to, as I'm sure you know, you reach that point where you got to let it go. You can't hang on to it forever and try to keep making it more and more perfect. And I guess my newspaper experience helped with that, because in a newspaper, you have to let the story go at a certain time. You can't hang on to it for another week or two. It's due and you have to turn it in. And that's just the way it is. So, you know, but I did really massage this and go back over it and over it. And, you know, I feel, I don't have any regrets at this point. I can't think of anything that I should have put in or wished I'd put in. I think I just, was ready. It was time for me to let it go.
Yeah.
It's like a child.
Yeah. Well, of course. Started writing. You said you're quite young, you know, in school. Did that come natural for you then? Were you just a natural writer?
I think I was to some degree. I enjoyed it. And that's a big part of it. If you like writing, then you're going to be better at it than you are at other things. But I think I was good. I was good at writing. I had never really done much in high school in terms of being on the student newspaper or their yearbook or anything like that. But once I got to college, I just joined the staff and ultimately became editor of the paper in college, and then started out on some small daily newspapers in Southern California.
Mm. So Lydia Phillips, who's one of your main characters.
Yes.
Who is Lydia?
Lydia is a very sort of type A driven individual. She's had a very successful newspaper career as a reporter and an editor. She has twins, and reaches a point where she works for a newspaper that, unfortunately, like it has happened with many newspapers in these days, is paper has fallen sort of on hard times. They get bought out by a private equity firm. They start doing layoffs. It's shrinking in size. So she decides, I'm going to quit and I'm going to stay home with my 4-year-old kids and rear them and be a full-time mom. And she, you know, does that and is happy to do that, but finds herself bored. She's had this, you know, very intense newspaper career where she's, you know, covered crime and chased down, you know, followed the cops and done all this work. And now she's home And she's not exactly June Cleaver. She doesn't want to stay home and bake cookies and garden and be the perfect mom. So she immerses herself in volunteer work, you know, ostensibly on behalf of her children, and then expands her horizons from there and just starts getting involved in all these organizations. And she's very diligent. And unlike many volunteers, she treats her volunteer work as a real job. So people are constantly elevating her to leadership positions and so on. And this starts to annoy her husband, Bill, who says, you know, by now her kids are teenagers, and he's saying, you know, you need to get a job. The kids are going to be in college in 4 years, and we could use the money. You're spending all this time doing volunteer work. So then when she takes over this president job at the swim club, he really goes ballistic, and that causes problems. But it kind of, I think, resonates with women who have faced that, who have chosen to leave their careers to stay home, and the frustrations and challenges they face in doing that. And I think for women trying to balance work and family, it's very difficult. And you find if you try to do both, you can't do both very well. It's just hard. So these are the issues that a lot of women face. So that's who Lydia is. And so she's taken on this presidency at the swim club. And of course, like all of her other volunteer work, she's, you know, working all winter long to get the club ready. She's on the phone all the time. She's doing all these, has great, great ideas to make things better. And she is, and so then of course the summer starts, the club opens, and things are not how she had hoped. It's not perfect. People are whining and complaining. There's problems. It's just very frustrating for her. But again, it's an all-consuming situation. And she's, in the course of doing this, she, of course, has ruined the family's summer because she spends all of her time dealing with the club, and they can't take a vacation. And, you know, her husband happens to be a great cook, and so he handles the cooking. But she really as the story unfolds, and, you know, she's dealing with all these problems, and then the mystery starts to emerge, you know, the dark, sinister events and bizarre happenings start to emerge, and she gets caught up in that. And, you know, her journalistic instincts take over, and she cannot stop herself from pursuing and figuring out the case. She doesn't completely solve the case, but she sort of stays one step ahead of the police. And of course, she's still, one of the characters that comes in is the cop reporter at the newspaper, who's also working the case, because now this story has come out that, you know, that there's media coverage of it. And so, but she's doing her own digging and her own investigative reporting, using her skills to track down what happened with the case. So, and as the more she falls into that, then of course she continually neglects her kids. That they're good kids, but she forgets to go to the grocery store. She lies to her husband of what she's doing. She goes behind his back because he's telling her to lay, you know, back off. And so she's facing that struggle of, you know, and I think one of the questions that emerges is Lydia a good wife and mother? Or is she just self-absorbed in this need to solve the crime? And so, and as the book goes on, it starts out more on the side of, you know, the crazy shenanigans and absurdities that happen at the club, and then arcs, and toward the end of the book, it's more about this sinister real estate scam that takes over.
That sounds like a pretty interesting book. You know, you could turn her into a detective in book two, and she leaves her husband and drops the kids, and
The kids are in college now. They're gone now. Yeah. She really doesn't have anything to do.
Yeah.
And her most steadfast companion in this is the dog, Stacy, who is a very spoiled, entitled rescue dog. But you know, she's always there for Lydia. While Bill, her husband's complaining about what she's doing, and the kids are kind of doing their thing. The dog is with her every step of the way. And I'm a dog person, and the dog is actually, we have had three family dogs, Stanley, Gracie, and Stella, and the dog Stacy is incorporates all of their names and sort of an amalgam of all three dogs, all spoiled, entitled, demanding rescue dogs. So,
So have you, it sounds like you put a lot of yourself into the character as well, right?
I did.
And so being that you do, does that kind of worry you a little bit, or do you feel, because of the social media world and everyone's got an opinion, and you can put the book out and it's got parts of you in it, but then people can say bad things about it, and therefore it kind of relates to you. Being especially with your first book, this must be a whole new thing for you in that way. So does that kind of make you feel a little bit vulnerable?
It does. I mean, I do feel sometimes very vulnerable. The character is, there are aspects of the character, Lydia, who are not like me. I don't have twins. I'm not blonde.
Right.
Things like that. But people have asked me, so they know, many people know that much about the character is myself. But that feeling of vulnerability is something I've never experienced. As someone who's had my byline on many stories, I've done thousands of interviews, and I've never felt this, I guess the word is naked. I feel like I'm exposing myself.
Yeah.
Exposing myself and the story, and people are judging me and critiquing me, and I've never experienced that, having it out there. And so I've had to learn how to kind of deal with that and myself.
Yeah, and definitely as you go onward in writing, I would say do not focus on that, because if you do focus on it, or if something does bother you like that, it takes your mind away from what you're doing. Your intention changes, and then all of a sudden you feel, because you don't want to focus on the noise. You want to focus on what you want to do. The story has to be good for you, good for your fans later, and all that. You just sort of do what you do, and it's a difficult thing to get through, but but if you keep your focus, if you keep it your eye on the carrot, so to speak, keep it on that. What you want to accomplish, it'll be fine, because there's always going to be people that don't like you. But that being said, is there anything that you'd look back at now in this book and you go, well, I would do that differently?
I'm not an outliner.
Right.
I've never liked outlines. And of course, as a journalist, you don't really have time to necessarily do an outline. I did do a very rudimentary outline, which was somewhat helpful. But, I know of authors who do these very detailed, 40, 50-page outlines. And I can't imagine doing that. But I think if you do that, I think it probably would have made it easier for me in the writing. I probably would not have had to resubmit my manuscript, maybe. So I would have thought about it more. If I'd thought about all these elements doing an outline, I might have been able to write the book better, been more organized about that, efficient, knew more where I was going, really thought more about what I wanted to include before I finished it. So I think I would be more diligent and deliberate about planning the book. I heard an author say once that before you sit down, before you write, or think before you write, don't start writing if you haven't figured out the ending. And don't start writing if you don't know where the book is going. You really need to know. And I basically knew where the book was going. I had the idea, but I kind of winged it in a way. I started writing, like was what I'm used to doing, just start writing. And I think I would definitely do it differently next time. I would be much more diligent about thinking ahead of time, planning it, going through, forcing myself to do a more detailed outline so that I knew more where I was going and what I really wanted to include in the book, rather than deciding at the last minute, oh, you know, that's a, that should include that. That's a good idea. And then having to figure out where to incorporate it and, you know, coming up with a scenario and dialogue and things like that. So that's definitely one thing I would do differently.
Yeah, that's interesting. What do you think about journalism that you had the years in there, and so you've come from it and you look back at it now? What do you think of the journalism in the current climate as it is, as we speak right now?
Well, I feel fortunate that I worked in journalism at a time when journalism was still, when newspapers were still very relevant and very much a part of the community. It was fun. It was, you know, reporters are wacky people in and of themselves, often great characters. I think what's really sad about journalism today is the loss of the community newspaper, the local newspaper. We are becoming a society that is, well, as far as newspapers goes, it's the New York Times, the Washington Post, the big papers that have are sort of dominating. Occasionally, there may be a small little community newspaper, but they're not really, they're reporting strictly on very local news, you know, society news or maybe school district and so on. And they're not doing investigative reporting. They're not really doing any digging. Then, of course, I think social media has had a huge impact on journalism, which I think is, you know, it's, maybe it's good in many ways, but not good in other ways. I think with the, even when I was working at the paper and the internet was really emerging as such a powerful force in our lives, it became very apparent that anybody can put anything on the internet and it doesn't necessarily have to be true. I think you see this happening. Whereas the newspaper was always sort of the trusted local news. And even if the editorial page didn't reflect your views, the stories, at least in my experience, the stories were reported fairly. I mean, when I was working on the city desk as an assistant city editor, we always made a point, if it was a controversial story, of getting both viewpoints above the fold early on in the story so that the reader had the opportunity to see that there were both sides of the story. So when I hear these things of fake news and so on, it pains me to hear that, because these are from people who've never been in a newsroom and have never really experienced the process of putting a story together and covering a controversial or high profile case where, you know, you have to have sources. And I know that it used to be that if we did not have named sources, we had to and the sources were anonymous, there had to be at least three of them before we would print it. And there were many times when we didn't have three sources and we couldn't print the story. So you know, it's unfortunate that it's come to where it is. I mean, the Denver Post is a shadow of itself now. It's very small, and there just is not the opportunity to really do in-depth reporting on stories that are important to people, that matter, that right. affect their everyday lives. And I know when I was at the paper, we would have budget meetings every afternoon where we would talk about, okay, what are we putting in this paper today? And oftentimes we would ask the so what question. Why are people going to read this? Why is this important? And I think we're missing that now. Everything is, you know, you can go to Twitter now and people can say whatever they want about anything. And sometimes it's based on facts and reality, and sometimes it's really not. And it's you don't get the opportunity to read a story like you used to.
Right.
So it's
no,
it's,
yeah, no responsibility to it either.
Someone no,
can,
none.
You can call yourself anything and put yourself on there and say anything, really, you know.
Right.
And you're not held accountable. Whereas if you're an organized news place, you're held accountable. You can be sued. You know.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, I had a boss, one of the first papers I worked for, my boss said, we publish our mistakes, meaning we can't hide. We can't, you know, if we make a mistake, we publish it. We own it. We have to write a retraction or a correction. We're out there and we're accountable. And that lack of accountability is really unfortunate. I think it's causing a lot of divisiveness and misinformation in our society, unfortunately.
Yeah, it's too bad. Now, do you have a website of your own that people can find you at, or if they want to send you some stories or talk, give you a message or anything? Do you have that?
Yes, I do. It's CatherineDeanNazarov.com. So my name, my author name, .com.
Well, that's easy. We'll have that up on our website as well.
People great,
listening
thank
can
you.
Do one click and find you, and it'll be all done. How did you have any issues with the COVID and stuff? Does that affect you when you write?
No, it did not. I had started the book long before COVID, and actually, with COVID, I sort of didn't have anything else to do. So I focused on the book quite a bit over the past year. As far as the actual writing of the book, it did not affect me. As far as being able to get into local bookstores and things like that, that's been challenging, as it has for all authors.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's that's just the way it is.
Yes, you're right.
not a lot you can do, you know. But I ask this of a lot of authors. Do you, you know, when there's a dark period, like, so things are going on. You've got, you know, the COVID, a lot of people dying. You've got anti-maskers, you got all this stuff going on, you know, Jewish laser beams, presidential election, everything's going crazy.
Yeah.
But with all that going on around you, though you are inside your house and stuff, does that seep into your writing, do you think? Do you think you kind of would get darker? Or some people also, they go lighter because outside is kind of, you know, a little bit turmoil going on, so they kind of write funny or lighter stuff. Does it have that kind of an effect on your writing either way?
It has not. It did not with this book, but of course I had, by the time the pandemic hit, the book was
pretty much
well on its way. I had written the book and I was in more of an editing, rewriting phase, and I was pretty focused on it. And I think the fact that my book has nothing to do with it, with the pen, it had nothing to do, of course, with the pandemic, but
right.
It was not really, there were a couple of places in the book that kind of address current events. There's a character who's clearly a bad guy and he's very racist and he throws this red meat out on the table occasionally. is what I call it. But beyond that, no, it did not, as far as this book goes, it did not. Now, if I were to start a book right now, or had I started a book last year, it might have been different. I might have been too distracted by what was going on to really focus. And I think I would have definitely, I would want to write a book that was light, which this book, I generally view this book as sort of a light, fun, funny read. It's an escape book. It takes you kind of away from all this for the most part. But yeah, to start a book right now, or as I said, in the past year, I think might have been more challenging because I might have just been too, you know, distracted by what was happening, not just with the pandemic, but everything else that's going on, all the other, the election, you know, everything.
Well, people get emotional, right? And you see a lot of fighting and a lot of upset, and it can affect your own personal mood. So then when you're writing in that kind of a mood, a lot of writers have said that it completely shut them down, and others, it didn't. It actually turned them on, so to speak. They went gangbusters. So I've seen both effects. It just, I don't know. I guess it just depends on the person themselves and their.
Yeah, you know. I think it does. It's an interesting point though. I mean, I can see how that would happen, depending on what kind of book you're writing. and your personality. I mean, I think the fact that I've written pretty much, you know, all, my entire career has been writing. So I'm used to being very disciplined that way and sort of being able to focus on it. I, like most writers, I'm sure I would only write maybe a few hours every day, rather than trying to sit at my computer all day and do it. And I, but yeah, I think definitely, I think outside events, what's going on around you definitely can influences all of us. And I can, as I said, if I weren't, had not been so far along in the process of my book, it might well have affected me. It might have motivated me and spurred me on, like you say, or it might have shut me down. I don't know. It's an interesting question.
We'll see on your next book.
Yeah, I'll see on my next book.
Yeah, you'll see. You know, because that because when you're writing in a current of affair, or current event, current time, I should say, really, a story, like when you sit down to write a sequel to this book, for instance, and how could you not have things going on in the world in it? You know what I mean? Like, I guess you could. You just could have totally ignore it.
Yeah. I think from what I've, my sense tells me that people don't want to read a book that has a pandemic in it right now.
No.
But, you know, that's interesting because I've always kind of thought in the back of my mind I would write another book along the same lines. And a lot of people have asked me if and when I'm going to write my next book. And I'm not ready yet. I'm not at a place where I want to start doing it. And maybe that's because I am being impacted by what's going on. So many things to deal with. And I just am not in a mindset to do that right now. I just, I you know, that's an interesting point. I had never really thought about that. But that maybe that's the reason. I'm just not in a frame of mind where I can sit down and focus on writing another book.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's important. I think
it is
because the frame of mind has to have, you have to be in that right zone. Cause the one thing I've found about writing books as compared to writing for a newspaper article would be, you can't just turn it on. You can't just go, okay, I'm free to write between 3 and 5 today. So, you know, and sit down and do it. Cause sometimes it just doesn't work. Whereas if you're writing a story for something, you kind of get the facts, you can kind of force yourself through it. Anyway, but that's,
I think you're very right about that. You're absolutely, that's true. And I think, yeah, writing a little short story or a couple page story is a whole different thing than writing, you know, a book or a lengthy magazine article where you don't have a deadline. You have to be motivated. You have to feel the need. You have to want to tell the story. And so, we'll see. I don't know. That's a really interesting point though.
Well, we'll look forward on your next book.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Okay. Well, we've been talking about the book Summer Club, a novel, and we've had the author as our guest, Catherine Dean Mazarov. Thank you for being here.
Well, thank you for having me, Al. I enjoyed talking to you.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel. A pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.